Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Christmas is not too far away, folks, so this might be one worth listening to. David Cawley has 20 years' experience in the acoustic and audio engineering industry and will argue that he's been working in the field for the previous 20 years as he began playing music in the family music school at the age of three. In 2010, he founded the acoustic and audio design consultancy Allegro Acoustics, and as CEO, he led Allegro Acoustics to become a front runner in the European acoustics, noise and vibration consultancy engineering industry. Having stepped back from this business in recent years, David founded One Sonic in 2019, the first and only Irish consumer audio brand. The first 4 years of operation for One Sonic were executed as a live feasibility study, focused on developing a comprehensive audio device range, market testing and gauging customer feedback. Now with a five product range on the market and a strong foundation to grow, One Sonic is entering fully operational phase in 2025 with a focus on the UK and mainland Europe as key export markets. David, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aidan. Hi, and hello to your listeners.
I hope I've gotten everything there right.
I'm exhausted with the amount you got there. I didn't realise I was that busy.
I know. Set the stage for me in regards to Allegro Acoustics and ultimately then the progression into One Sonic.
Yeah, sure. It's probably important to point out, as with most entrepreneurs, I suppose you'd call us, that I've had put zero time into preparing for this wonderful chat. So this is off the cuff, 100% raw content. So set the stage, Allegro Acoustics. So basically, I've been playing music since I was 3 years of age in our family music school back in Roscommon. And I studied engineering in college. But I spent most of my time in college playing music, founded a band and signed to a record label and all that. And we'd fully intended on being even bigger than U2 and all that. But I got to a point where I actually realised, you know, I love the routine. I love the 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 or 9 to 12 as it is when you're self-employed. Mm-hmm. I like that and I like staying fit and healthy. And the music industry is the opposite of that. So I went into acoustic engineering in about 2005 in my early 20s. And I only worked in it for about 4 years. And when I was 28 then, in 2010, economy was absolutely crashing and I'd always wanted to sort of set up my own company anyway.
Right.
And I never thought I'd actually do it in acoustics. I felt it was too close to home for me, you know. But I did really understand it and I did enjoy it as well. And I said, oh, sure, look, this company I'm working for, things aren't looking good for them. So I might as well do this. So I founded Allegro Acoustics really to just continue on working while, you know, while the recession was happening. And I figured I'd be able to survive in the recession on my own anyway.
Yeah. And what was the nub of what Allegro was? What were you trying to solve? What were you trying to achieve with it?
So at that time, right, most acoustic consulting and audio engineering advice and consulting services were being imported into the country from the UK.
Okay.
We pretty much had no acoustic consultancies, like just bespoke commercial consultancies like Allegro Acoustics. So I figured straight away, even though the demand would be lower because like, and the recession back then was brutal, you know, a lot of your listeners might remember. So even that aside, I still figured we could still compete with guys coming from the UK because at least we wouldn't have to travel, you know, so it was very basic. So I set up Allegro Acoustics to service the local market really. And I'd built a good profile. I just started my master's in acoustics in the University of Surrey. So it was really about just, you know, servicing a demand that I could clearly see was there. And I enjoyed the work. So
Who were the end customers then?
So I did a lot of work in like the power gen industry, pharma, biomedical, in terms of environmental and occupational. We worked with some audio and technology companies on the design of products. So basically any physical hard thing, either a building, a power station, a factory, or even I even worked on mice, you know, the mouse, the clicky mouse. We worked on a mouse to make it quieter. And I worked on some audio projects with speakers, cabinet speakers to make them sound better. So basically, it's kind of like you would say it's a specialist area, but my work went across a whole broad range of different types of projects.
Right. Okay. When I think of, what about the progression into One Sonic?
So basically, in terms of One Sonic, I'd always wanted a scalable type of business, right? I didn't like the fact that with consultancy, while it was really enjoyable and I was good at it, I didn't like the fact that it's you know, consultancy is tough because first of all, you're selling time for money and you only have so much time, right? Secondly, I was using a massive amount of brain power in the office. You know, we built a team and I could see the massive amount of brain power we were using and, like, you know, working on complex kind of projects and stuff. And as soon as we've the project finished, there's no, like, follow on. That's it. It's over. And so I wanted to move into something that we could design once and scale. And I thought about it for a couple of years. And I also desperately wanted to be in an export position.
Right.
You know, because the Irish market, it's lovely and it's great and all that. It's tiny, you know, and it's really, really small. We're literally a quadrant of London. Yeah. That is the Irish economy. So I wanted to get into a position where I could export. And it just kind of, it wasn't like a light bulb moment for me, Onesonic. It was more I realised that there was this blatantly obvious glaring light in front of me all the time that I hadn't really seen. And I realised, do you know what I need to do? I need to found a brand that I can leverage and pivot my skills in audio and design once and scale that way. Right. So it was a logical move.
Move, true. When I think of consumer audio technology, the last place I would think of is an Irish company in consumer audio. So how did you come on that? How did you come about that as the product that you are, the thing that you wanted to scale?
So the funny thing is, when I thought about the idea initially of launching a small product range, and I came up with the idea of the Onesonic term, like in a single moment. But when I Googled that back then, or you ChatGPT today, should I set up an audio technology brand? The answer everywhere is no, don't. Bad idea.
Yeah.
Over, like, the reasons being perception that it's oversaturated market and very difficult from a marketing perspective. To crack the market. And it's B2C, right? So you have to get into the psychology of the customer. You can be the best product in the world, you know, but if you're not marketing and getting through to the customer, you're not going to go anywhere. So so you know, I figured that, you know, do it anyway, because like, for a start, you know, when nobody else wants to do it and if everything is saying don't do this, right, I figure straight away, well, I'll definitely do it because it means I've less competition straight away, right? So, in terms of an Irish audio brand, we are the first and only Irish audio brand. I seriously don't think there'll be another for a good long time because it's not easy.
Yeah.
And we don't even have undergraduate training in Ireland in audio engineering.
Okay.
So we have to import a lot of talent. And then one of the crucial bits that I found out after I'd gotten up and going was that, we have our investment community here, venture capital funds, private equity. They're very small, but they have no experience in consumer electronics. Yeah. They have no experience, certainly with consumer audio, never mind consumer electronics. So the problem there is you go talk to VCs and say, yeah, we've done this great thing. We've invented a brilliant product range. It's all good. Look at this, listen to this. And they'll all go, oh, that's great. And we like you. It's fantastic. Love what you're doing. But we have no data on this. So we can't make a decision.
Yeah.
So really hard to get investment in that space. But again, and we were turned down by a number of VCs for those different reasons. And the hardware, people don't like hardware, it's complicated. And all of the things that people didn't like, I actually instinctively liked. Mm. I was like, that's good, actually. I like that. I like that challenge there because that's a barrier to everyone else. Mm. But for me, I can work my way around it. So, like, all of the reasons for no for me were actually, yes, I'm definitely going to do this.
So in terms of the business service, then you're really just, you're designing the product and then getting somebody to manufacture it, are you?
So I kind of, you know, it's never any harm to basically imitate somebody else who's done it on a business level. And if you look at any of the big brands like Apple, for example, and it's no harm naming them, everybody knows, says in the back of every Apple device, designed in California, and it's made in Shenzhen, China. Yeah. And we're designed in Ireland, and we're made in Shenzhen. So we've wonderful partnerships with our manufacturers in Shenzhen that manufacture for us and all that. And we've developed relationships there over 10 years now. So people often say you don't manufacture in Ireland. Mm. We don't manufacture anything in Ireland. No. You know, it's commercially not feasible. Mm. So that's why we do it that way.
Yeah. Speak to me then about, like, if you were thinking about that and all the various different things in it, going the consumer versus the professional route in terms of your end market, right? Like, you know, you're given your background and things like that, you're obviously, you know, sound quality, or that's really, really important and probably fits much more into a professional end market than a consumer end market.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you've picked up on. So, like, what we do, basically, the reason Onesonic exists is because, you know, I found back 7-8 years ago, before I set up the brand and before I started, that, you know, up to, if you want to buy a pair of headphones or earphones, up to €100, right, which is where the most of the market is, you won't get quality.
Yeah.
You don't get good sound quality. And what that means for me that understands it is you don't enjoy your music as much as you should, right? So if you want to get the sound quality and you want to get the audio engineering so that you can really enjoy your music, you're up over €200.
Yeah.
So basic strategy for us is we're by and large within the 100 to €200 bracket.
Okay.
And we simplify the technology so we keep our costs down, but we maximize audio engineering.
Okay.
So basically, our product is all about good sound quality and keep it simple. Sound quality and simplicity. That's what One Sonic is about. And in terms of the, what you're talking about there really is B2C versus B2B.
Yeah.
You know, and in Ireland, we're brilliant at B2B. And even we've had great discussions with Enterprise Ireland. They've been really supportive and they're supporting us now. And the truth is that most of EI's experience is in B2B. And, you know, that's what we do as a country. And the reason we do it is very simple. It's because we're good at hopping on a plane, going out to some lad in Germany, chatting the chat, have a couple of beers, job done.
Yeah.
Business won, go home the next morning, my job is done for the week. We're good at that. So for me, and I've done that a lot, and it's not difficult for me, but to try and win business through the B2C, when you can't do that. You can't stand in front of the customer, you don't have line of sight
to the end customer.
You don't. And to me, it's fascinating because you have to find a way of communicating your brand, communicating what you're about, basically through PR, social media, your marketing, your go-to-market strategy, all that. And that's where you really have to get clever with the psychology of marketing. We're taking that now the last 3 years, really understanding. Because that's where you can really, you know,
that's where
you can differentiate, and that's where you can get your brand on the market successfully.
Yeah, like it's interesting you mentioned it at that point. I was going to ask you, you know, like, there's that old idea, right? Like, if you don't advertise, you may as well be winking at a woman in the dark, right? So how do you say, what is the market approach and the brand approach as you start looking for UK and Europe in terms of advertising One Sonic and what it is and differentiates itself?
So we went through a process. For example, in one of our early years, a very senior marketing guy said to us, we turned over $500,000 in our first year, like basically straight off the bat, right? And I was talking to one of our senior marketing guys and I was all about turning over $3 million the next year. And your man said, listen, how do you know you're even going to turn over the $500,000 you did last year, next year, never mind $3 million?
Yeah.
And I said, actually, we did it last year. What are you talking about? Sure. Didn't we do it last year? We'll do it this year. And he goes, well, how do you know? And I was like, sure, we'll find a way. And he goes, who are you selling to? And eventually I realized, you know what? We don't have an answer to that. We don't actually know who we're selling to. We, you know, went out with a broad brush in marketing, in the marketing social media space, and we got a bit of turnover. But at the end of the day, if at that time, 3 years ago, if you were to say, right, we did this, this and this. Now we're going to do that multiplied by 20 in Germany. We had there was nothing there.
Yeah.
So like the audio piece was easy for me, you know, getting the product range, which you would think is the hard bit. The audio piece is pretty easy for me. But it was building that strategy of who are we selling to? And we spent 3 years working that out. We spent three solid years working out who our customer was and why they would buy from us, what they wanted, what their preferences were, how much they wanted to pay, how they wanted to use the device, you know, everything. And like even to the point that I was in a gym in London recently and I wanted to see what sort of earphones and headphones people were using, you know. And there was one particular girl on a treadmill and she was wearing all luminous green clothes, right? And I was like, and she also had luminous green headphones, like the same tone of luminous green. And I was like,
coordinate, did you not know that?
But that's a serious level of coordination. So I was like, what brand headphones is that? And I walked by the treadmill and just discreetly as any man can.
Yeah.
I discreetly took a glance at the headphones. She's wearing a pair of JBL headphones. And then I realized she was like also like wearing a lot of perfume. And I was like, Jesus, the gym in London isn't just about exercise. It's as a whole, like, you know, do you call that vanity? I don't know, in the gym, and I go to the gym and I'm probably as every bit as vain as anyone else. But there is a whole, look at me, look what I'm wearing, look at the headphones I'm wearing.
It's not just in
London. Yeah, it's not just in London. But I figured after, anyway, I was like, do you know what? Do you know when you're close enough to your customer and when you understand your customer is when you can smell them. That's how close you need to be. Especially when you're trying to crack a market like we are. So at the end of the day, we have identified a very clear customer that we're targeting, and that customer is quite a small portion in Ireland, but in the export markets like the UK, in mainland Europe, Germany in particular, there's a much bigger cohort of that customer. So we're going directly to that customer in our marketing from here on.
And then, okay, that's in your marketing. And so is that then about literally directly pinging them, or how, what will the go-to-market strategy look like?
You told me at the start of this interview that we had between 35 yeah. and 50 minutes.
Yeah.
It's multi-layered. You know, okay. At the end of the day, if you put yourself in the shoes of the customer, right? Supposing you're a 35-year-old male, you like going to the gym, just to stick with the same topic, you like going to the gym, you want a pair of headphones that won't fall off, that are comfortable, and you can really, you know, enjoy your music because it's good sound quality, and they look pretty good.
Yeah.
Right? So how do we target that customer then? You know, and it's about social media. It's about where we put the brand out in what I call just in real life. You know, we've a number of different channels that we're marketing through now, and much more so between now and Christmas that people will see. And, you know, it's ultimately to, you know, we know what that customer wants and we have built it. And it's our job now to say, hey, you over there that are looking for this, we have this for you.
Yeah.
So it's multi-channeled.
It's a funny thing though, when you think about it, right? You know, the way the earphones have gone now, they're so discreet and they're in your ear and things like that, right? But the problem is, if you have brand ambassadors, that doesn't, like, because you remember the old thing when the football players used to be coming off thing and they had these massive big cans and it was blatantly obvious what earphones they were wearing. But when they have these tiny little things, nobody can tell the difference.
That's right. And we've actually purposefully, we've always had our brand very visible on all of our product for that very reason. Because, you know, when somebody buys a product of ours, and we've a rating of 4.8 on Google, which is like, and that's 100 and I think it's nearly 200 reviews.
Right.
And they're all completely like authentic. Yeah. You can't fake that anyway. So they are our customers who we know and they're saying good things about the brand. And those people are out in the open with, you know, our product.
Yeah.
And the best real estate for your brand, in my opinion, is on the customer.
Yeah.
And we're better than on the side of someone's head. I mean, that's why we've always had our brand very visible.
Yeah. What do you think sets you apart in what is a very competitive market with some very massive players? Like, you really are a David and Goliath thing type situation.
Yeah, we are. And I do love that. I'm comfortable in that zone. You know, I've kind of been in the David Goliath position my entire life, actually. When I was in boarding school, I was always a small guy that people were laying into and stuff. So it's kind of natural for me. It's kind of like, you know, someone said to me recently, I'm a bit like your man at the end of the movie Hurt Locker that defuses bombs. And at the end of it, when he can finally go home, he doesn't want to. He just goes back in. So I think there's an adrenaline addiction there that I will deal with it later. But you know, to answer your question, how do we deal with the big brands? Like, to me, like, I love it, right? Take Apple is like the second most profitable corporation on the planet, right? After Saudi Aramco, who are selling something they're drilling out of the planet. I mean, that's easy. So for us to be on the same shelf as Apple and selling product before someone, like, I've been in stores where we've had our product and product from big brands, and customers come in and buy our product. And the first few times I saw that, I was just blown away. And, you know, to think that we could actually achieve that. And to me, I don't do this, look at the German market, it's worth, you know, X amount of billion, we can win 1% of that. I don't do that. I think that's nonsense.
Yeah.
We do the bottom up thing. How do we win the first customer? You know, it's always about that first customer. So I guess that's a good mentality to go into effectively what is a David and Goliath style war, really. And, you know, it's all about just giving the customer what they want. How do we differentiate? Sound quality is a big thing. Like, the main reason people buy audio devices is to listen to music. So that's why we've gone down the sound quality route. And I went down that route anyway because, you know, I enjoy listening to music. I know what good sound quality is. And I know why you want it. So that's,
but do you think most people can tell the difference between good sound quality and bad sound quality?
Do you know what? Most people don't realise they can tell the difference.
Until they get something that is better sound quality.
Yeah, and most people eventually work out. And you're right, it isn't like, you know, you do need to be tuned into something. But eventually people realise, yeah, I do like this, or no, I don't like this. When it comes to audio, you know, when it's not something tangible that you can look at, you can see, you can measure, you can weigh, it's an intangible in a lot of ways. So most people do eventually work it out. And that's where we come in to build brand loyalty. Our customers eventually love the product, and therefore, you know, it's good for the brand. Look, it's really all about understanding what the customer wants and giving it to them, and keeping it that simple.
Where did the entrepreneurial spirit come from? Or are you an accidental entrepreneur?
That's a good question. I come from kind of a farming background in the west of Ireland.
Right.
And I think
there's an innate entrepreneurialism about a farming community. Listen,
I don't know any farmers that don't have a bit of an entrepreneurial vibe about them, honestly. Having said that, I've lived in Dublin like 20 years and my hands are very soft these days. So I wouldn't be much good on the horse farm down home. But I think we've always had, like, maybe it comes from our upbringing. And I think in the context of the country, we're actually very young as entrepreneurs, you know, because the state was only founded 100 or so years ago, right? And, you know, if you look at what we've done, we'd come out of a civil war first, you know, we'd form a government then. You know, like, we've actually, as a country, I think we've done phenomenally well.
In a very short period of time.
In a relatively, really short period of time, because, like, you know, there's big companies and big brands that have come out of Ireland and, you know, they've only really just come up, you know, in recent decades. And for a tiny, tiny country. So I think all of us in this country have some level of entrepreneurial spirit, really. In my case, I guess, you know, there's probably a lot of background there. My mother is a retired music, maths and business studies teacher and accounting. So, like, I'm an engineer that went into music and I've set up two businesses. So I like to say I didn't take
didn't
much from
that. Off the ground, But then when you were setting up the businesses, you know, did you look for, because, you know, when you set up a business, you have to wear an awful lot of hats, right? You know, you have to be the product design, you have to be the accountant, you have to be the this, the that, and the other. Did you bring founders in or did you try to do it all your own and on your own at the early stages?
Well, I'm still wearing a couple of hats. I have a wardrobe full of hats at the minute. No, as like in the early days, absolutely, yeah. And you have to, like, there's no doubt, you really do have to have a fairly good knowledge. In my case, I had to know, like, in depth what I was doing from a product point of view. Because if you get that wrong, you just forget it, you know. But I did have to very quickly upskill myself on the marketing piece. You know, and understand, because you can spend a lot of money in marketing and if you don't know what you're doing, you waste money. And then the finance. Look, I've run my other company since 2010. So running a business is something I can do naturally, and building teams, you know, I've had plenty of experience there, which is great. And I enjoy that. But I think even so, like, now we have a fantastic CMO in place. We have a fractional CFO from Agile Exec in Sandyford who have been absolutely brilliant. Like a real step change for us was bringing in fractional people, you know, that could come in, like, hit the ground running with serious expertise in marketing, sales and finance. And Agile and Sandyford helped us do that, which was really brilliant. And, you know, like, then as your business grows, you need to plug those seats, like, you know, as someone can.
Permanent plugs,
And for me, every time I hire someone new and give, you know, hand over responsibility for an area for them, basically I see it as firing myself from a job. That is a good day for me, you know, and that can go on. Like, there are so many facets to One Sonic. Like, I definitely think at this stage, it's probably a lot more complex than a lot of standard, like, startup. It's way more complicated than my first business,
right?
You know,
why is that?
Well, the marketing piece really brings a layer of complexity.
Okay.
And there's a huge psychological aspect to that, which I find fascinating now and I enjoy it. But it does bring those extra layers. And, like, for me, I had to really up my own game, you know, in this context, because, and I mean, from a personal perspective, like, I actually had to, I'm relatively fit. I've always jogged like 30 kilometers, 40 kilometers a week. I've been in this pool. But then I had kids and that wrecked everything. But I've had to use every opportunity now to stay fit. Like, I cycle about 15 kilometers a day, bringing the kids to school. And, like, every opportunity I have to stay fit, get fresh air, eat well, sleep well, so that I'm on form when I'm in the office. And it literally takes all of my capabilities at that level. So you do have to wear all the hats. And if someone thinks, you know, you can siphon something off to someone else and sit back, it's just not, I wish it would happen with me sometime soon or at least in the next 5 years, but it doesn't happen.
I suppose the other thing too, with the difference between One Sonic and Allegra, was you have a physical product this time rather than a service. So there's a whole manufacturing element to it. You have a physical product, so there's a supply and logistics element that wasn't necessarily in the Allegra one, because it was a services one. So it's actually, you know, a more complex, if you will, company that's ultimately being run.
Yeah, and the way I find it on a business level is you have to have contingency in every move you make. I'll give you a good example now. Do you remember leading into Christmas 2022, when the ship ran into the side of the canal?
That
created a nightmare that took me 12 months to recover from the trauma for. Because what happened was, All of a sudden, nobody could ship anything by sea freight out of Shenzhen. Mm. And we were air freighting stuff. So the price of air freight went up by like multiples.
Yeah.
And there was also delays. So I was facing a situation really, really quickly where we would have, you know, ship product by air freight and potentially wouldn't even have it in for Black Friday to sell it. So can you imagine paying way over the odds to get it in and then not selling it because,
didn't have it there.
So like after that, out and out, beyond a nightmare. I've had bad nightmares that weren't a patch on that. And after that, I said to myself, right, when it comes to shipping, we have to have multiple strategies in play at the one time. Just set up a system that's strategic and we're always hedged, basically. And we're always looking at the lowest cost option, which means time, which actually brought us back to a whole other question about finance and funding and having cash to do what we needed to do at the right time.
The journey of OneSonic has been a little different to most other startups because, as you said yourself, it is kind of a live feasibility study, right?
Yeah.
What was the difference in this approach for the company?
So I remember I was out for a jog one night in about, it was March 2020, just before COVID hit. Right. Sorry, COVID had hit and it was just after Leo at the time announced that we were going to lockdown. Closing up shop. And I went out for a jog at like 1:30 in the morning, which would be a normal enough thing for me to do. And I was thinking, right, and I remember my head was kind of in a, there was a buzz in my head because I was like, okay, I don't know what we're going to do with OneSonic now. And I don't know what's going to happen to Allegro Acoustics because none of our staff can work.
Yeah.
So I was like, this is the biggest business challenge we're going to have faced 100%. And I'm in the worst possible position because we were about to launch OneSonic in some certain way. But ultimately we switched our tact really, really quickly. Mm. And instead of, we were going to launch one Bluetooth speaker on the market, low risk, low everything. And we switched tact altogether to doing the R&D and product prototyping and manufacturing on audio wearable headphone and earphone that we launched 7 months later, which is like a record time to get a product from basically design phase through to on the shelves. And the reason I did it was because, and that's why we said we'd do this as a live feasibility study, because we'll do it really to learn and get data. And, you know, the reason we did that so quickly was I was killing a couple of birds with one stone. I also figured back that March, I was like, do you know what's going to happen now? Nobody's going to be in the shops this Christmas because they're going to be shut down. Mm-hmm. And everyone was saying, it'll be 2 weeks. Even friends of mine that were in medicine, GPs, are saying, this is only a virus. And I was like, have you not seen the repeating rate of this thing? I was like, this is going to be going on for 2 years. And I knew it at the time. So I said, you know what we'll do? We'll launch audio wearables and get them on the shelves for this Christmas because A, people won't be able to go to the shops, so we'll be able to launch online. And B, everybody will be at home and they'll need headphones for communicating and listening to music and doing their workout at home. And like, that is exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. So we continued that on as a live feasibility study to get data because we couldn't buy any data. And, you know, that gave us so much data on who the customer is, who would buy a product from a new brand. And we expanded that out across 4 years to build a full-blown go-to-market strategy internationally and to learn a lot more about the customer, which we knew nothing about at the start. Mm. So we filled that entire gap with the feasibility study over 4 years.
Mm. With success that you've seen so far, right, there's always the risk that you start getting distracted. Okay, and you've got your five products now, and you were telling me in the new year there'll be another one launched. But how do you kind of keep the focus that you want to grow and innovate, but you don't want to get distracted and go down rabbit holes that ultimately don't fit the overall path that you want OneSonic on?
Yeah, it's a brilliant topic for any person in my position. Mm. How I actually deal with that is I talk to the right people.
Okay.
There's a number of people, like especially like there's four or five good friends of mine. One of them is in his late 70s, who's had a business for 30 years, and we'd have coffee every so often. And staying focused on that sort of end goal in sight. Mm-hmm. And one of our investors as well, he's in a similar, you know, he's 50 years in business. Mm. And I do have a coffee with Porrick every so often. And he'd be saying, why are you worrying about that? You need to be worrying about this over here. And like having that experience, and I'm 44 years of age, and, you know, fair enough, I have 15 years as a CEO in two different businesses, but there's nothing like experience from people who are kind of on our side, yeah. like, you know, on my side, and that I can talk to and I enjoy talking to and having a coffee with. And that's how I stay focused, is right. by opening your mouth and opening your ears. You yeah. know, it's the best way, because it helps you see the wood from the trees in your mind, and, you know, lift your head up from the weeds, as we call it in business, and look further down the track and always be focused on where you're going down the track, because it's crucial. Otherwise, you end up in 2 years' time not knowing where you are and where to go. You know,
and what do, on the innovation side of it, what does the product pipeline look like then?
So we always kind of, you know, one of our real strengths is audio R&D and okay. product design, creating new product. And one of the things that you have to accept with the audio industry, the audio sector, is it's continually evolving. Mm. You know, what people want is shifting year to year. I'm very lucky now because I you know, I have an interest in it myself.
Yeah.
And I'm always looking at what people are doing, what devices they're using in the gyms. And like right now, for example, some of the people over 30 in the gyms tend to be using all earbuds and earphones, whereas the youngsters, 20 to 30 bracket, they're using like over-ear headphones.
Yeah.
So that's a change from last year,
yeah.
you know? And you need to be really on top of that in terms of the products you're developing and that. So, yeah, we're always watching those trends, I guess. And watching, you can often see for trends in Western Europe, you see those develop in Asia first, or maybe the US first. Very much watching the trends. And like if you take Apple, for example, Apple are probably the only company in the world that really do set a trend.
Mm.
You know, they were actually one of the first to launch the AirPod on a commercial level, you know. So like real trendsetters, and they're plowing the way for a lot of people, so a lot of different businesses. So it's really about, you know, spotting the trends. And, you know, in terms of us, like product innovation, our new headphone that we've launched, I feel it's a bit of a trendsetter because it's a kind of a retro-ish metal look, our Studio Pro headphone. It's a metal look. It's a different looking headphone.
Right.
And we feel that that is not necessarily what the customer would say they want if you asked them. But when the customer sees that and feels it and look at it, yeah, it'll be their preference then.
Yeah.
So you've got to be watching what the trends are and where you think the trends will be in the future.
You raised the issue of customers, and ultimately they're great at telling you what's wrong with a product, but not necessarily what you're telling you what the solution to the problem is. So how do you get around that interaction with customers and feedback and all that type of thing?
Well, we often talk to our customers through our retail outlets.
Okay.
It's a really good place to get really solid customer feedback. Because especially when it's a customer that's literally just, if you take, for example, one of our stores, we have a stand there, and myself and Neil, our brand partnership manager, go in there and we just watch people come up to the stand and let them try product and, you know, see what those initial impressions, you know, they count for so much, because somebody is, they kind of have their guard down then.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not watching, you know, whereas if you ask somebody, come back to me in a week and tell me what you think, they're kind of under pressure. So it's very much for us, it's very much, we have a really good relationship on the retail level, and we've learned so much from it about the customer. That's where you find your customer, you know, is when they go shopping, basically.
Yeah. And when it comes to that level of innovation, right, as you see out and you kind of get more and more successful on the sales side of it, How are you going to make sure that the level of innovation on the product side of it doesn't start kind of just falling by the wayside? That, and, you know, that focus, you said yourself, we're very much an R&D focused company, right? But as you get bigger and the sales side gets bigger and everything else gets bigger, you as CEO have to manage that side as well. So how are you going to keep that kind of hunger for innovation up?
We are, funnily enough, I think we're unique in a lot of ways, but We have to control the urge to innovate.
Right.
You know, like if I went totally unleashed, we'd launch 20 products next year.
Right.
You know, but that's madness, and it's too much, and it's too much for the customer to take in, and it creates a website that has too much going on. You know, because there are so many different needs out there amongst the customer, different customer sectors. You know, this customer wants that, another customer wants this. So you have to whittle it down. And I'm always putting the brakes on innovation in some ways. You know, just to keep the shape, right? And really for the other stuff, the beauty of OneSonic is it is actually really scalable as a company. You know, certainly now that we've gotten to this stage, it's very, very scalable. Like our marketing is very, very scalable. Create good content once and put it in the right places multiple times. And the sales piece is about building a team and a good sales team. And like the marketing is such a big driver, because that's bringing the message. Your go-to-market strategy is so crucial. But all of that is scalable. And then again, the innovation itself is scalable, because we design a product once and sell it like tens of thousands of times. So in a lot of ways, the first 5 years for us has actually will proven, I believe, to have been by far the most difficult.
Yeah, okay.
Because once you get to that critical mass and you build your team and you're not doing everything yourself, basically, you know, then you can start sort of driving the ship, which is the point we're nearly at now, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm much like that we got this far. I'm looking forward to the rest, to be honest. But if someone was to say, would you go back and do that 5 years again? I'd say I'd rather go to hell for 5 years than go and do that again in some ways.
Yeah. And like in terms of the product line, you said you're very much a B2C type model and that's fine. Can you see scope for a B2B or a professional line, you know, that professional audio market where you know people like the sand lads here might have their own earphones but they come into it and they're using a completely different set of brands when it ultimately is in the office. Do you see the scope for OneSonic to be in the professional end of sound?
No, not a hope. And the reason is that one of the reasons I set up OneSonic was I bought a pair of wireless earbuds in the airport a couple of years ago, back in 2018. I was going on a long flight out to South America and I was just shocked at how poor they were.
Right.
Obviously, I'm not stupid, so I'm not going to name the brand because they're massive and they would sue me.
And I don't want them to sue me either, thanks very much.
Yeah, no, we'll avoid that. And I couldn't believe how poor they were for the money.
Right.
You know? And basically, you know, I thought, at the time, I said, I could definitely do a much better job than the guys here. So ultimately, what I felt was, well, where we want to be is giving the customer the big audience, like the mass market, a great quality product, a product that they love, a product that they enjoy, a product that they can enjoy listening to their music with, and at a cost that isn't big brand money.
Yeah.
So we set ourselves up from an R&D perspective to design product so that the factory cost will come in at a level that we can still be profitable and the business works very well. And the customer gets it at a decent price. So it's about mass market. It's about the people, you know, for us and people enjoying music. I think for people to enjoy music is a great thing. I think music is a great thing for people to listen to when you're working, if you want to relax. Like I've got so much enjoyment out of music in my entire life that I think it's important that when people want to enjoy music, they should.
Or podcasts, folks. Or podcasts.
Absolutely, podcasts. Get educated.
How do you deal with setbacks?
It's a daily basis. look, at this stage, to be honest with you, like you kind of, certainly when you're on your second business like I am, and it is inevitably more difficult when you take on a much bigger animal in my case, you do have to get very comfortable with what your own limitations are and what your own boundaries are. And everybody has their limits, 100%. But one of my strengths definitely is I just refuse to fail, if you like. I just won't, you know, there's this thing out there now that
I have a question here. Has fear of failure been a driving force for you?
Listen, don't be afraid of failure. Be terrified of regret, but never be afraid of failure. I have never in my life been afraid of failure. I'll try anything. And I don't believe for a second in the phrase, especially when it comes to business, fail fast. It's a phrase I absolutely abhor. Because if you believe in a business and if you believe in what you're doing, you're going to have setbacks. Like, geez, I went through 2 years of absolute hell from the point of view of not having enough cash to do what we needed to do. And I still wouldn't sit back on the R&D. I was still driving on R&D. And it was very, very difficult. And I mean on a personal level, you know, like we're past all of that. We're well past all that now, thank God. But there was a period there, 2021, 2022, that it was very, very difficult. And any day would have been a good day to throw in the towel.
Yeah.
Any day. But I just decided not listen. It's kind of like, you know, I surf a good bit, or I certainly used to before I had kids. And there was one mentality I learned from surfing, and it's that any surfers listening will know this moment when you get on the board and you're especially on a beach break, you paddle out to get out the back, out beyond where the wave breaks, and you paddle hard, and it's a big day, and all of a sudden you're absolutely out of breath. You haven't got out the back and you're about to get nailed by a wave. Now, that's happened to me a couple of times. And it has happened to me a couple of times in like big, big waves. Ones that you're like, okay, the risk of death here is definitely above 25%, you know? And you're sitting there on your board looking at it. You're trying to get the last few breaths in. And you enter this sort of mentality of, okay, well, the wave hasn't hit me yet. I am here now. Yes, I have about 3 seconds of definite life left to make some key decisions. And when it happens and we'll deal with it. And that kind of tempers your mind in a way. It certainly tempered mine. So when I was up against some of the biggest problems we had in business 2-3 years ago, I actually found myself resorting to that mode. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we have a problem that's really going to hit us in 2-3 weeks, 4 weeks. It hasn't hit us yet. We can still make decisions. We're still here. Let's use everything we have to mitigate, avoid, or deal with that problem and that risk in whatever way. And we survived all of them, you know? So that's how I deal with setbacks.
And what about, you know, managing your board or your investors when things aren't going well?
Look, I think communication is key. I like, if there's one thing I'm able to do, it's sleep at night. I've always been able to sleep. I've never not been able to sleep as a result of business. And I like being able to sleep because you need to be able to sleep. Yeah. You need the 8 hours to keep the mind clear, make decisions. And I think the crucial thing with investors and the, you know, the way I operate with all of our investors is communicate.
Right.
Tell people what's going on. Always, I think if there's one thing that'll piss an investor off, it's if they invest money and they don't hear from you.
Yeah.
And if I was an investor, that would annoy me. I would get really annoyed. So like I do my quarterly updates. I make a point of it. Even from the point that we only had our 4 initial investors, great lads. No matter what was going on, I'd update the lads after every quarter and they'd be able to weigh up, right, that's where they're at. Let's see what happens next quarter. So, you know, I think it's really important to communicate and be transparent. I'm not into making stuff up or covering stuff up because, you know, you end up someone, the last thing I want is someone to say to me, but you said this you're now saying this. That is one phrase that, you know, would annoy me. So I don't do it. But yeah, communicate.
But then, you know, when you go back then and you mentioned the 4 big investors from the start, you know, have they been completely aligned with you and your vision for OneSonic from the start?
I think all of our investors are kind of looking at the company and looking at me as a CEO. And they all, I think, I'm pretty sure, have made the decision. He sounds like he knows what he's doing. Mm. He's fairly determined to do it. So let him go, you know? I think that's probably a fair assessment. And that's probably how I'd feel. So, yeah, it hasn't been, none of my investors have said, we want you to do this or the other.
Right.
And a lot of the decisions anyway that I'd make, especially if they, you know, on that level, I'd kind of look for consensus as well. Just to, you know, I like having people on board. But, you know, if people understand your reasons for everything and it's very obvious what the next step should be, then it's easy to get consensus, you know.
What mistake do you think you learned the most from? So between the two businesses?
Between the two businesses, you know, in all honesty, I learned a lot of nuts and bolts stuff from Allegro Acoustics.
Right.
It is one thing I learned from Allegro Acoustics in the earlier days is I have very little patience. And if there's one thing I would have learned from that business, it would be never let your lack of patience come out your mouth.
Yeah.
You know, there have been the odd occasion there and I have wonderful friends in Allegro that may or may not be listening to your podcast. Maybe it's better. I won't tell them actually. But they're wonderful.
Tell everyone.
Okay, we'll tell everyone. A wonderful group of people and they'll know that on occasion I would have lost my patience and it would have come out my mouth. Mm. And you know what? That just creates hurt in a team sometimes and upset. And that's one thing I would definitely wouldn't allow happen. In the last couple of years. And with OneSonic, it was actually a crucial thing to learn because I had much, much bigger reasons to lose my patience with OneSonic. And I just decided, you know, keep things stable. That's a really, and with it, you know, I am an impatient sort of person. So that would be a weakness of mine. But that'd be a big thing I've learned there. With OneSonic, look, a lot of it is, you know, make up your mind on what you're doing and be decisive and do it and commit to your decisions then. And I've always done it that way. I guess I've learned a lot about how to manage the cash flow side. And there's some things I did in the earlier days in respect of, about how we used cash. Like we used to buy stock out of cash, for example. And a good supporter of ours, Dermot, in the, you know, VC space said, you shouldn't be using your cash to buy stock. You need to get a finance facility. And I was like, but Dermot's expensive, blah, blah, blah. But like simple stuff like that, the finances. Get the financial model right. And like, I'm an engineer. I've no excuse. Engineers are fluent in numbers. So it was really easy for me to get up to speed with where we need to be at financially. But definitely now, that's a crucial thing I've learned from OneSonic is make sure you get your finances solid and get the numbers right and be, you know, spending in the right ways at the right time and have a system there. And that's been really important for going forward, I think.
Well, what's the culture in OneSonic?
Great question. The culture in OneSonic, we have found out...
Are you a whole load of noise nerds that just love to make the best mousetrap-like thing?
No, not like... Your culture gets away from all that. Like we're very God, how do you describe it? We're always very positive about stuff, right. And we like to communicate and call stuff out. We're a no bullshit outfit, really.
Right.
You know, there's no room really for people like taking ownership of their space. And people are proud to do that in with the group that we have. Like we've an amazing group, you know, and we've the right group. And you know, we had some people that for one reason or another weren't possibly the right fit. But it's, you know, when you start building a group of people that are the right fit, and that's really where we've gone down is like transparent, good communication, and positivity. And we don't do blame game or any of that. And we always support each other. And the reason we do all that is because I think as a group, we personally get on and we personally like each other.
Yeah.
And we're not at the, you know, if you're a big corporation, you have to really think about culture because you have so many different people, but we're not at that point, which is good because, you know, it's a lot easier to manage. And we'll keep it that way as long as we can because there's a lot of positives, you know, in the office if you do it that way.
Do you obsess about the small things?
Utterly, yeah. Utterly, yeah. It's painful, actually. You know, my wife would say, you know, you can be very difficult to be around. And I'd say, well, you should try being me for a while. It's actually way worse. Yeah. But like attention, you know, only when it comes, I've seeded a lot of stuff in the marketing now. I used to be very protective of that and the brand and the tone of voice and all that. And I've let that out a little bit, which has really been a process for me. But I will still, and I unapologetically, will remain highly pedantic when it comes to product.
Right.
I absolutely obsess about product. And I'm the lead product designer and the CEO, so I'm kind of a technical CEO.
Okay.
And when we're developing a headphone, I'll test it. Like I could spend 14 hours in one day just doing one test over and over and over again until I get it exactly where I want it. And I literally won't stop. And I won't change that. And I think it's no harm. You do need to sort of break away from that every so often though, because you could end up in a, you know, in a padded room if you go and do too much of that.
As the CEO, you know, and as you've progressed on, do you think you are, you know, not necessarily getting better at the job, but you're getting quicker at making the important decisions, identifying and making the important decisions?
We were talking about this recently, a bunch of other people in a similar space about the psychology of scaling, right? And it's very much where kind of we're at when Sonic is at right now, because we've got the whole system, the foundation built, and we're going to scale now. And at the end of the day, to me, scaling is all about decisiveness, you know, decision making. And you got to get yourself, I've had to get myself into a position. I'm a pretty good decision maker. I'm pretty decisive. But to make good decisions, you need to be able to see all of the facts as clear as you can in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to be decisive when you can clearly see everything.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't clearly see everything, or if you don't have all the data, and you can't, then how do you, you can't make a decision. So like, that's all about decisiveness and you know, making quick decisions, and then the quality of your decisions determine the, you know, the success of your business.
Yeah, yeah. So on that basis then, when it comes to decisions, are you data-based or gut-based?
I'm both.
Right, okay.
I'm definitely both. And, you know, in some, you see, with a fast moving industry like the audio sector, when it moves so fast, a lot of the time the data you buy off the likes of Statista or whatever, you know, it's old data. It's 2-3 years old. Yeah. And in that case, if your instinct is good and if you're really, you know, and don't forget, a lot of people in finance tend to, they kind of underestimate instinct on some level. But, you know, what is instinct? For me, right, if I make an instinctive decision on where a headphone design should go, I'll make that decision because I'll have seen how people use it in the gym, how people will use it out for a walk, how people use it out jogging, and what they're otherwise doing, and what I'm seeing on social media, on TikTok and all the rest, and then I make a decision. And people will call that an instinctive decision, but it's actually not.
It's a data-backed decision.
It's 100% data-backed decision. Yeah. So at the end of the day, if you ask me, real instinct, when you really know what you're talking about, that is actually data-based, you know? But it's just not put the whole thing through an Excel spreadsheet. It's just make the decision.
And then given the nature of the market, are you a fast or a slow decision maker?
Fast.
Fast.
But normally I'll have the decision made before the question comes up because I'll have been thinking about it anyway.
Right. Fair enough.
That's a bit of a smart arse answer, isn't it? Sorry. Right.
The other one then in terms of the business itself is when it comes to people within it, are you a hire from without or develop from within?
Big believer in develop from within.
Are you?
100%, yeah. In terms of hiring, I, at this stage, and like I've been hiring now, when you're hiring for your own company for 15 years like I've been, you learn a lot, you know, and going back to your instinct piece, at this stage, I absolutely hired the person first, a team person first that I know I can work with and that I want to work with and that can work with the rest of the team. Mm. So I hired the person first all day, every day. And, you know, people then bridge the gap in terms of the expertise. And when you're communicating and you like working with people, people learn really quickly. Mm. So, yeah, we basically hired the person first and then build from within, 100%. Yeah, it's been the one successful hiring strategy that we've had, I've had in both companies over time, is that strategy.
Mm. What's your approach to change then? Because it's a very changeable industry that you're in.
Change to me always means opportunity.
Right.
You know, if things were to stay the same, then, you know, sure, nothing would ever happen. Mm-hmm. Change is what we're looking for. And, you know, things like COVID and, you know, turmoil, lack of stability. I love that sort of stuff because it always creates opportunity. Like, funny enough, I founded my first business in 2010, just before the real jaws of the last big recession got at us. And I founded my second business in 2020 in the middle of a 100-year pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I'm naturally... everybody else seems to run away from the stuff that I run full tilt towards for whatever reason, I'll never know.
Do you hate losing or love winning?
I effing hate losing.
Do you?
Yeah, I really do. And I'm a sore loser and I'm a horrible person when I've lost. I remember playing my cousin in a game of tennis 20 years ago and he reminds me of this all the time. And when I lost against him, right, I picked up the ball and I like belted it at him and I hit him right in the middle of the stomach and he had this massive red tennis ball bruise on his stomach for about 3 weeks. And I just hate losing. I absolutely hate. And I wouldn't even say I love winning. I do. I like winning. Yeah. And I love when we
celebrate the wins.
Not enough.
Right.
Not enough. No, I'm a bit of an addict. I move on to the next war. And yeah, it's a good question. And like, I'm kind of at that point now. We've had a lot of great wins. One Sonic has had some fabulous wins the last 12 months. And I feel like we haven't as a team celebrated them. And if any of the team are listening, we're due a big celebration. And I have it booked. But yeah, it's really important in business, especially for your team, you know, and for the people to identify and recognize a win, you know, and a victory or a successful period. Mm. And celebrate it. You have to. It's absolutely crucial. You have to stop and celebrate. Yeah.
What advice would you give to young people in terms of setting up a business or their career or just general life?
God, I really, you know, the more, like we focus on and listen to young people a lot and Gen Z a lot. And the more I learn about the younger people nowadays, and I'm like, when you go over 40, you really do lose touch with that generation. And the more I learn about the younger generation now, the less I feel I understand. You know, well, I do understand it. I think the younger generation now are, honestly, I think they're very, young people now are very demoralized in one way. Because, like, young people in this country can't buy a house. Mm. You know, there's no point, you can't save because you're paying massive rent in Dublin. And, like, you know, I think it's very difficult on young people today, actually. And... you know, what advice would I give to young people today? I don't know. God, a risky business. I'm thinking of all my answers and they're all like, no, don't say that. No, don't say that either. And definitely don't say that. Look, do you know what advice I would give young people, especially in business? Do what you love.
Yeah.
Do what you enjoy. In terms of picking your career or if it's a business, like I've never done a business for money reasons. Mm. You know, I've done business for... business reasons and to enjoy running the ship and stuff, but never for money reasons. And I've always done what I actually enjoy. And I think it's the one thing that's across all generations, and a 90-year-old person would say that to you, and it's still relevant. But I would always say, do what you enjoy. And if you have a dream, you know, of something you'd love to do or whatever, do it. And do it when you're young, because, you know, once you reach your mid-30s, 40s, you need to start getting serious about stuff and all that. But when you're young, that's the time. Like, when I finished college, I spent the 3 years after I finished college playing music, and we recorded a load of albums and we signed to a record. Now, we didn't make a success of it, but we learned so much and it was so enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know, and you've loads of time to get, you know, throw on the shirt and slacks and get into the, or whatever, and get into the...
put up the grown-up pants, you know?
Yeah, loads of time for that.
Yeah. Who do you seek advice from?
Who do I seek advice from? I seek advice from a lot of people.
Yeah,
I confide in a lot of people. I've some really good friends that are in businesses as well. And I'd talk to my dad a lot, you know, and dad would be a great old advisor. And my parents, both my parents, my key advisor, I have to say, it would be my wife, Aisling.
Right.
Like there's been, like Aisling has listened to so much, like every day, I mean, and some days I come in and she'd just say, would you just not today? You know, but Aisling has given me some great advice. And look, I've at this stage, like I've some really, really good pals in business and professionally and that work for us and stuff. And I talk to everybody. I think talking to people whose advice and opinions you respect is so important to keep you in the right place in business. So yeah, I seek advice from everybody. I don't necessarily take it, but I definitely listen to it.
Yeah. Right. Come to the black book moment. You better keep your fingers crossed.
God, I was nervous when you told me about this at the start. I wasn't fully aware of this.
But yeah, you see, I'm not going to tell you. You wouldn't turn up if I did that. Right. All right. Given where you are, this could be an interesting one. What are you most looking forward to over the next 5 years?
What am I most looking forward to the next 5 years? That's a lovely question, actually. Especially given that the last 5 years in that early stage in business was, first 5 years in any business is tough. Assuming we're talking about business, which is the context. I'm looking forward to building our team and, you know, scaling and continuing the scale journey that we're on. And I'm looking forward to bringing more people in and creating a nice team of people. I love building teams and I love working with people and I love working with people that I enjoy working with. And I'm really like, there's so many roles that we've designed the entire role, and I'm really looking forward to filling those. And if we're lucky to get the right people, then superb. So I'm really looking forward to that stage and seeing OneSonic really grow and, you know, have people enjoy what they do and be proud of it. And, you know, OneSonic is the first and only Irish audio brand. So I am really looking forward to seeing that go international properly. I'll be happy when that's done.
And have you thought of an exit strategy?
Look, you're supposed to have an exit strategy. I think in some ways you have to look at every business as a start, execute and end.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course. And when you have investors on board, you have to respect that they'll be looking for an exit. But look, having said all that, we've a target in 5 years and I spend every working minute of every day thinking about that target and working towards it. But otherwise, decisions we make are not made based on an exit strategy. They're made based on building a brand and building a great company. So yes, but it's not the decider for everything.
Right. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, David Cawley. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.